opportunity. So there's a contempt, a sneering contempt for these people who are not in this powerful Epstein class. But there's always an endless opportunity to make money off of these people.
I'm going to end where you end your New York Times piece with the courage of the Epstein survivors, writing, quote, "The unfathomably brave survivors who've come forward to testify to their abuse have landed the first real punch against Mr. Trump. In their solidarity, their devotion to the truth, and their insistence on a country that listens when people on the wrong end of power cry for help, they shame the great indifference from above. They point us to other ways of relating." So let's turn to Epstein survivors. Survivor Teresa Helm on Democracy Now! In July.
We cannot continue to have these people or systems continue to get away with anything that they can get away with, because they're skating through, they're dodging accountability. There's too much money involved. So, you know, people silence through money. We have got to change. It's degrading our society to continue to allow these predators and perpetrators to get away with harming so many people.
And in your final comment.
I would respectfully correct something that Virginia Giuffre said. She said she was trafficked to a bunch of leaders.
The beginning, yes.
I would say she is a leader who was trafficked to a bunch of cowards. There and all these women have proven themselves to be the actual leaders, because leaders are brave, they take risks, they do what's right even when it's not convenient. And what has been revealed ultimately by this Epstein story is that we are led by a group of people who do not deserve to be called leaders. And these women point to what leadership looks like.
Anand Giridharadas is the author of several books, including Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. He's the publisher of the Inc. newsletter on Substack, and we'll link to his piece in the New York Times headlined How the Elite Behave When No One's Watching Inside the Epstein Emails. Coming up, we look at Venezuela as the Trump administration ramps up military pressure on the Venezuelan president. Stay with us. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Venezuela as the Trump administration continues to ramp up pressure on Nicolas Maduro, the president of the oil-rich nation of Venezuela. On Monday, the U.S. top military officer visited Puerto Rico. General Dan Kane, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, met with troops in Puerto Rico toward a Navy warship. In recent months, the U.S. has amassed over 15,000 troops in the Caribbean. The U.S. has also bombed over 20 boats, killing at least 83 people, claiming without proof the attacks have targeted drug traffickers. Meanwhile, Monday, the Trump administration formally designated Venezuela, the Venezuelan entity known as the Cartel de los Soles, or Cartel of the Suns, as a foreign terrorist organization, the Pentagon claiming President Maduro is the head of the group. Venezuela called the move, quote, ridiculous, saying the group doesn't actually exist. Last week, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said the terrorist designation gives the Trump administration, quote, a whole bunch of new options, end quote, to deal with Venezuela. On Monday, Venezuela's oil minister, Delcy Rodriguez, accused the Trump administration of targeting Venezuela because of its vast crude reserves, the largest in the world. We're joined now by two guests. Alexandra Avina, associate professor of Latin American history at Arizona State University, extensively researched and written about capitalism, the U.S.-backed war on drugs, so-called, and state violence. He's the author of the award-winning book, specters of revolution, peasant guerrillas in the Cold War Mexican countryside. He's joining us from Phoenix, Arizona. And in Caracas, where we'll start, is Phil Gunson, senior analyst for the Andes region with the International Crisis Group. Yes, he is based in Caracas. Can you tell us, Phil, how are people responding right now in Caracas and throughout Venezuela as the U.S. takes yet another step, killing over 80 people, claiming that they're involved with drugs, though presenting no evidence, but amassing this massive military presence and designating the president of Venezuela the head of a foreign terrorist organization? What's happening in Venezuela right now?
How are people reacting? Yes. Hello. I think there's a range of reactions, obviously, but I think I would sum it up by saying that those people who want to see the back of Maduro, and of course there are quite a lot of those, are just anxious for the U.S. to get on and do it, if that's what they're going to do. And those people who are nervous about what might happen, whether they're government supporters or not, would like them to just go away and leave us in peace. We're now in a situation where there are very few international airlines flying in and out of Venezuela. We're becoming once again isolated from the world. And of course, this is making life even more difficult in a country that's been suffering a humanitarian emergency for the last decade.
So, Professor Alexander Avina, if you can talk about, I mean, your specialty in Latin American history at Arizona State is looking at U.S. military interventions, what this could mean, although the latest news, according to Axios, is President Trump is willing to speak with Maduro. It's not clear exactly what's happening at this point, a conversation or an invasion or a bombing of another country.
Good morning, Amy. This is hopefully the news coming out recently are accurate. I think, you know, the history of U.S. intervention in Latin America is one full of carnage and mass human suffering. Recently, in the last couple of months, since the U.S. started these extrajudicial executions, some analysts and journalists have made the comparison to the U.S. invasion of Panama in December of 1989 as part of Operation Just Cause as some sort of potential counterexample as a successful instance of U.S. military intervention in a Latin American country. And I would just say that as of right before the pandemic hit, people were still digging up and looking for clandestine graves of Panamanian civilians who were killed by the U.S. military intervention, particularly when the U.S. bombed the working class neighborhood of El Chorrillo that then becomes known as like Guernica or Panama's Guernica. So this is a potentially really frightening moment, particularly I think the fabrication that the U.S. is advancing to justify what is quite openly a regime change operation. I mean, the drug trafficking charges, we can get into those if you'd like, but this is quite open. This is an open regime change operation with a very thinly veiled justification.
And if you can talk about the significance of General Dan Kane, he's the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, going to Puerto Rico, what this means and how Puerto Rico has been used as a hub for the military as they launch more attacks on the Caribbean.
Yeah, Puerto Rico is often referred to as the world's oldest colony. So it's a tragic situation for the people of Puerto Rico that their land, that their island is being used potentially as a military gathering and operation site against a potential intervention against Venezuela. So, this general's visit to Puerto Rico is one of the warning signs, one of the potentially warning signs that we see in terms of a potential U.S. intervention against Venezuela in whatever form it may take. But there is an irony there that it's the oldest colony being used to exercise and project U.S. imperialist power against a sovereign nation in South America.
Phil Gunson in Caracas, what is this Cartel de los Soles, the Cartel of the Suns, that the Trump administration has targeted and said Maduro is the head of this, quote, foreign terrorist organization, which is, of course, the next step to legitimizing an attack?
Yeah, the first thing to say is that the Cartel de los Soles, the Cartel of the Suns, which is a reference to the suns that Venezuelan military officers, high-ranking officers wear on their epaulets, like stars in the U.S., it's not an organization at all. It's a term. It's a label that was applied, has been applied over the last few decades, even from before Hugo Chavez came to power in 1999. Applied to corrupt military officers who were taking money from drug traffickers. But it's not an organization. It's a state of mind, if you like. And maybe in the most extreme case, maybe networks of military officers who collaborate. But it's certainly not a cartel. It's not a drug trafficking organization. It's a reference to the fact that over time, I mean, particularly in the last 20 years, the corruption in the military has become a real issue in Venezuela. And of course, you know, Venezuela lies right next to Colombia, where most of the world's cocaine comes from. Some of that cocaine comes through Venezuela. The military as a whole are charged with controlling that traffic. And therefore, they're in the front line. Therefore, they're more exposed to being paid off so that the traffickers can move the drugs through Venezuela safely. But to call this a narco-terrorist cartel is frankly ridiculous. I mean, it has nothing to do with terrorism. I mean, these people are in it for the money. They're not aiming to send drugs to the United States to undermine Western civilization. And in fact, most of the cocaine that's heading through Venezuela is going to Europe and not to the United States. Most of the cocaine going to the States heads north, up the Eastern Pacific, up Central America, which is not to say that drug trafficking isn't a problem here. It is. But if you want to address it, you have to start with a real appreciation of how it works. And calling this suggesting that there's something called the Cartel de los Soles and that it's a narco-terrorist organization is a really bad start.
Professor Avina, if you can talk about Venezuela as a first stop attack, moving on to other Latin American countries, of course, going after, for example, Colombia and President Petro next.
Yeah, I think there is a broader plan within the Trump administration for the entire region, not for Venezuela. I think when Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth went to the Panama Canal Zone last April, he said, quote, to put America first, we have to put the Americas first. And that's a long historical pattern of any time we have a U.S. politician or movement that defines itself as isolationist, that's always bad news for Latin America. That what that means is that you're going to have a renewed U.S. imperialist attention to the region and a more overt projection of U.S. imperial power in the region. So we've seen the U.S. already get involved in at least discursively and monetarily with election meddling in Argentina. There's elections coming up in Honduras. We have U.S. officials on the ground, particularly under Secretary of State, causing problems over there. There's also efforts to influence Guatemala's judicial elections that are scheduled for next year. So I think there's a broader program or idea. And unfortunately, it's being led by a particular group within the Trump administration and Congress, mostly from South Florida, right? Marco Rubio is the representation of, is the leader, so to speak, of this movement. It's a particular political movement that is extremely right-wing, revanchist, anti-communist, and they've been waging this war to push back the left in Latin America to go against social movements in Latin America for decades now. And now they see their opportunity and they're trying to take advantage of it. Marco Rubio, Representatives Carlos Jimenez, Mario Díaz-Balart, and Maria Salazar. They're really pushing some of this movement. And so what we see is Venezuela is just one potential site. I think we're starting to see this emerge more and more against Colombia. We've seen, obviously, saber-rattling against Mexico. So this is something to watch. It's not just about Venezuela.
And, of course, Marco Rubio, Cuban-American, Cuba. Do you see that as the ultimate target?
I think that's what they want. I mean, we've seen reporting from Axios talking about really ridiculous things, right? That Maduro can't leave power in Venezuela because the only way he would leave is the Cubans would put him in a body bag, right? So for this movement in South Florida, Cuba is the nexus of everything that's wrong in Latin America. And they've been trying to undermine Cuba for decades now. And that's the real prize in their eyes.
Alexander Avina, I want to thank you very much for being with us and ask you this final question. Do you see an attack on Venezuela succeeding?
No. What I do see it happen, it depends on how we define success and from whose perspective. But I think what we can be assured of is any sort of attack on Venezuela, it will be illegal. It will be a violation of Venezuelan national self-determination and sovereignty. And it will create mass human suffering. And whether it's successful or not, I think it remains to be seen. I think the people of Venezuela will defend their country, but we can be assured that this will create mass human suffering. It might create more displacement, and it will generate mass human movement, potentially some of it to the United States. And we'll see, what I see is a coming together of three wars that the Trump administration is waging. The war on drugs, the war on terror, and the war on migrants are coming together in this particular way that they're trying to manage and initiate a conflict with Venezuela.
Well, Alexander Avina, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Associate Professor of Latin American History at Arizona State University, and Phil Gunson, Senior Analyst at the International Crisis Group based in Caracas, Venezuela. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at Brazil, where former President Jair Bolsonaro has been arrested after he tampered with his ankle monitor while under house arrest. The arrest ordered by Brazil's Supreme Court Justice, Alexandre de Moraes, over fears Bolsonaro would attempt to escape his compound days before he was due to head to prison. In September, Bolsonaro was sentenced to 27 years in prison for plotting a military coup against Brazil's current president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Bolsonaro served as president of Brazil from 2019 to 23. During this time, deforestation of the Amazon increased by 75%. Well, we turn now to Angela Mendes, the daughter of the late Brazilian rubber tapper labor leader Chico Mendes, who was assassinated by ranchers decades ago in December 1988. Chico Mendes worked for years to preserve the Amazon and to protect the rights of Brazilians living in poverty and indigenous people. Angela lives near where her father was born and raised, in the northwestern Brazilian state of Acre. I spoke to her last week at the UN climate talks when we were in Belém, Brazil. And I began by asking her about her father's legacy and what led to his assassination, December 1988.
My father, during all his life, he fought for the rights of his companions, his friends, and the peoples of the forests. For a long time, his fight brought a lot of prejudice, a lot of backdrops for the farmers in the territory. And Chico Mendes always fight in a pacific way, but they, the farmers, didn't like him at all. Chico Mendes always tried to dialogue with all forces. They created the empates, a way of protest pacifically in defense of the forest. But this was making all of them very angry about the threats about against their economic interests. So those empates were the way they found to defend in the forest. His fight.
Uma grande área de seringal onde a nossa família vivia.
When farmers came and buy lands in the forests.
UDR, União Democrática Ruralista.
Those farmers were supported by a local organization called UDR, the Federation of Landowners. And Darli Alves, one of the farmers in the territory of this organization, was trying to deforest a large area. And then she commanded fight for more than 90 days with his friends, defending this land, stopping deforestation. And this was the main reason why he was killed, to stop deforestation in December 22nd. It was organized, a pistol man, a killer, was hired to kill my father in his house.
Angela, talk about what your father did. What do rubber tappers do?
The rubber men organized this greatest movement, the empates, a peaceful one of resistance. In 1970s, the rubber areas, the native rubber areas, were impacted by major agribusiness companies that were expelling them from their territories.
Para que eles
for them not to lose all those areas where they lived, they began to organize those empates, those rubbermans. They lived more than 100 years in the forest. So they protect these areas together with the original indigenous peoples. And then together, they created an alliance of peoples of the forests, indigenous peoples, and the rubber men, the extractivist men that were living there, living from the Castanha do Pará. They had the same enemies, the farmers, the men that were stealing the territory from those traditional peoples. So they unite their force, indigenous peoples and the extractivist peoples. The farmers had a lot of money, a lot of power. So the alliance of the peoples of the forest is the way, the solution that they thought that what would be possible to defend themselves.
So you marched with rubber tappers on Thursday here in Belém, in the gateway to the Amazon. So many environmental activists like your father, hundreds have been killed since he was assassinated. Talk about the dangers people face who stand up for the environment right through to COP 30 to today.
And until today, we have a lot of, in our territory, a lot of people being threatened by the same people, cattle ranchers, agribusiness. They are trying to use the forest as cattle production, for cattle production. And they are defending the interests of agribusiness and mining companies. But here, there in Acre,
mas toda a Amazônia, né, o Pará,
we do not have mining in Acre, but the whole Amazon suffers a lot of threats because of those mining companies and agribusiness companies. They are coming from Europe for the Amazon. They come here, build their companies, bringing death to the territories, bringing death for the forests and threatening the peoples of the forests.
Can you talk about when Bolsonaro was president and before, his alliance with the ranchers, with the oil companies, and then Lula becomes president? And I'm wondering your assessment of President Lula. Are rubber tappers, are indigenous people any safer? And what is the Chico Mendes Committee calling for, Angela Mendes?
Lula was always, when my father was killed in Acre, Lula was friends with my father. And because Lula came from the working class, he understood very well the importance of my father's fight for my father and his friends. My feeling today is that the setbacks, the prejudice, how the negative things that Bolsonaro government did were too deep, were very profound. And today we have a Congress, an upper house, extremely right-wing fascist, and they are leaving the legacy of Bolsonaro as well. And they are making all they can to stop Lula of making progress in the democracy agenda. The Ministry of Environment, Marina Silva, they are all being put in a very difficult position. This is the project of our congressman, to make difficult, to stop the work of President Lula and his team that is prioritizing the protection of the peoples of the forests. And sometimes we manage to fight and show, we know that we have a reduction of deforestation in Amazon, but this was a victory, but we have still a lot of challenges, because every day we have
a new bill being voted in the Congress to try to invade and make the environmental laws weaker. So it's a different situation. The threat is against us, all this together. We had a bill of devastation, the forest devastation bill, destruction bill, that made more fragile the environmental laws in Brazil for the licensing to explore the forest. All those laws, the agribusiness is really trying to enter the territories, to destroy those territories, to kill the local populations. Today we have generations of peoples of the forest, indigenous peoples. They are contaminated by the mining residues because of the rivers are also poisoned. The population as a whole think they are safe, but the rivers are connected. So we know that the worry should be general. The whole people should be worried. As we also know that defend the forest is not something just from the people that live in the forest. We should know that everything that happens in the forest are connected to everything else that happens in the world. If we are in the city, we should be worried about the people in the forest and vice versa. But this barrier is still there. We share the same oxygen. We are in the same home.
Talk about why this brings tears to your eyes, Angela.
Sim.
Yeah.
Então devemos todos, né? É. Bom, eu fico triste.
I am very sad. And I cry.
Porque como há 37 anos,
as 37 years ago when my father was killed,
ainda vimos,
I still live today,
mulheres,
seeing women
que estão à frente,
who are in the leading and as leadership is in their territories being killed in a very cruel way. The feeling is that we are never able to get out of this violence that really marks people's lives and families, and we have so many things to deal with.
Thousands of people, particularly indigenous people, local people, have been marching here in Belém. Many of them wear your father's image on their t-shirt. Become a symbol like Che Guevara. And I'm wondering at this point, while there is so much at stake, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope is to know is that we know have today a youth movement, a youth that is very conscious about their role. Know that my daughter, who is here in the COP, dreams and wanted to continue the fight of my father. Every year since he was killed, we organize the Chico Mendes Week, where we have the youth working, that the legacy of his work continues.
Angela Mendes, the daughter of the Brazilian rubber tapper and labor leader Chico Mendes, assassinated in 1988. He fought to preserve the Amazon rainforest and the indigenous people who live there. We spoke to Angela Mendes at the UN Climate Summit in Belém, Brazil, last week. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Get ready for Listen Up. The Geography Student Union presents a night of live music starting at 5 p.m. on November 29th at the Student Union Building Ballroom on SFU Burnaby campus, featuring Sleepy Gonzalez, The Lunchtime Band, and Tiger Really. Tickets are $15, available online or at the door while they last. Open to all ages and everyone.
CJS.